Welcome to the Jerome Stern Distinguished Writers Series. We're glad to be back from the break. So today we're going to hear readings from Meg Carney and Dana Levin.
And here to introduce our first reader is Dorsey Ulbrich. Please give her a round of applause.
Meg Carney's most recent collection of poems, Home By Now, was winner of the 2010 Penn New England LL Winship Award. It was also a finalist for the Patterson Poetry Prize and Forward Magazine's Book of the Year. The title poem of Home By Now is included in Garrison Keillor's Good Poems, American Places Anthology. In a review of Meg Carney's book, Home By Now, Anne Marie Oman writes, "In a literary world where poems may become obtuse in order to reflect a fragmented universe, these pieces are refreshingly direct without being simplistic. Carney's poems do address an unstable world, but they do so in lines laced with a compassionate, if arcing, eye." While Carney's poems address themes ranging from femininity and sexuality to family relationships, loss, and identity, one of the most compelling threads connecting the poems in Home By Now is that of the unstable world Oman refers to. Carney's speakers attempt to negotiate legitimate fears and concerns without allowing themselves to be controlled by them. They perceive the real danger of a man's joking reference to a serial killer of women, the inscrutable color codes that designate national threat levels, but they strive to focus on the possibilities of the future, the comfort of jokes told in a local bar, a daughter with her face pressed to a train window. Much more than fear, the poems resonate with a desire to triumph over it, to move beyond it, all while acknowledging its undeniable power. Carney's first collection of poetry, An Unkindness of Ravens, was published by Boa Editions in 2001. Her work speaks to a wide variety of audiences and demographics. In addition to her two collections of poems for adults, Carney is author of The Secret of Me and its sequel, The Girl in the Mirror, two novels in verse for teens. She is also the author of a picture book, Trooper, the winner of the 2015 Kentucky Bluegrass Award. Carney's poetry has been featured on Poetry Daily and Garrison Keillor's a Writer's Almanac, and has been published in such publications as Poetry, Agni, and the Kenyon Review. A four-time nominee for the Pushcart Prize, Carney was also the recipient of an Individual Artist Fellowship from the New Hampshire Council on the Arts, the New York Foundation for the Arts, and the New York Times Foundation. She lives in southern New Hampshire and directs the Solstice MFA in Creative Writing Program of Pine Manor College in Chestnut Hill, Massachusetts. Please welcome Meg Carney.
Hey, everybody. Thank you, Dorsey. Yeah, thanks to that one guy who just said, hey, back. It's really great to be down here in Florida where we could actually sit outside to eat dinner. Those days are gone until spring where I come from. So we've got the wood stove cranking at home, and it's about 35 degrees last I heard, so really glad to be here. And I want to thank Keith and Aaron for bringing me down here, and Bob Shikochis, who unfortunately isn't here, but he's an old friend, and I was really glad that he suggested me as a reader. And what an honor and pleasure it is to read with Dana Levin. Thank you. I'm really looking forward to hearing you. I'm going to start with a poem that I heard in the fall of 2001. It was just a few weeks after 9/11, and I was traveling, doing some work on American Indian reservations, and I heard this poem that was written by a fourth grade boy named Cameron Penny. And I knew we were going to be going to war, and it seemed like a really important poem for the moment. And I thought, oh, this is a poem that I'm going to tell people about for this short period of time that we're going to be at war. And of course, that time is still here, and who knows what's coming. So I just want to share these words from Cameron Penny, who was in fourth grade in 2001, so must be probably out of college now. And Cameron said, if you are lucky enough in this life, a window will appear on a battlefield between two armies. When the soldiers look into the window, they don't see their enemies. They see themselves as children, and they stop fighting, and they go home and go to sleep. When they wake up, the land is well again. I kind of needed that poem last week after the election, and I hope that we can all wake up and the land will be well again someday soon. This is a poem from my first book, An Unkindness of Ravens. It's called Creed. And I guess it's a time when everybody's kind of looking at their belief systems and value systems. This was inspired by a poet named Jack Weiler, who was a very good friend of mine who died of AIDS about 10 years ago. And he wrote a belief system poem that made me want to write my own. I'm a native New Yorker, and now I live in New England, so usually I have to apologize because I'm going to mention the Yankees, but I don't think anybody here really cares about the Yankees. I don't have to worry about you throwing stuff at me. Creed. I believe the chicken before the egg, though I believe in the egg. I believe eating is a form of touch carried to the bitter end. I believe chocolate is good for you. I believe I'm a lefty in a right-handed world, which does not make me abnormal or gauche or sinister. I believe normal is just a cycle on the washing machine. I believe the touch of hands has the power to heal, though nothing will ever fill this immeasurable hole in the center of my chest. I believe in kissing. I believe in mail. I believe in salt over the shoulder. A watch pot never boils. And if I sit by my mailbox waiting for the letter I want, it will never arrive. Not because of superstition, but because that's not how life works. I believe in work, phone calls, typing, multiplying, black coffee, write, 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 dig, 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 sweep, sweep. I believe in a slow, torturous sweep of tongue down the lover's belly. I believe I've been swept off my feet more than once, and it's a good idea not to name names. Digging for names is part of my work, but that's a different poem. I believe there's a difference between men and women, and I thank God for it. I believe in God, and if you hold the door and carry my books, I'll be sure to ask for your name. What is your name? Do you believe in ghosts? I believe the morning my father died, I heard him whistling Danny Boy in the bathroom, and a week later saw him standing in the living room with a suitcase in his hand. We never got to say goodbye, he said. And I said, I don't believe in goodbyes. I believe that's why I have this hole in my chest. Sometimes it's rabid, sometimes it's incoherent. I believe I'll survive. I believe early to bed and early to rise is a boring way to live. I believe good poets borrow, great poets steal, and if only we'd stop trying to be happy, we could have a pretty good time. I believe time doesn't heal all wounds. I believe in getting flowers for no reason. I believe give a hoot, don't pollute. Reading is fundamental. Yankee Stadium belongs in the Bronx. And the best bagels in New York are boiled and baked on the corner of 1st and 21st. I believe in Santa Claus, Jimmy Stewart, Zuzu's Petals, Arbor Day, and that ugly baby I keep dreaming about. She lives inside me, opening and closing her wide mouth. I believe she will never taste her mother's milk. She will never be beautiful. She will always wonder what it's like to be born. And if you hold your hand right here, touch me right here, as if this is all that matters, this is all you ever wanted, I believe something might move inside me, and it would be more than I could stand. Your twain has arrived. I don't know if you guys saw the really awesome broadsides that where are the people who did the broadsides? Whose name? Thank you, artists who did the broadsides. There you are. They're amazing. They're gorgeous. They're out on the pool tables last I saw them. So the broadside that they did of my poem Carnal is just stunning. So I want to read that for you. This is from Home by Now, which kind of has one foot set in New York and another in New Hampshire, where I moved in 2005. And this is called Carnal, and it has a line that I steal from the poet Donald Hall. I won't tell you which one it is. Some of you will know. Carnal. I suppose squirrels have their hungers, too. Like the one I saw today with the ass end of a mouse jutting from its mouth. I was in the park. I'd followed the stare of a dog, marveled as the dog seemed to marvel that the squirrel didn't gag on the head. Gulped so far down the squirrel's throat, nearly all that was visible was the gray mouse rump, its tail a string too short to be saved. The dog and I couldn't stop gawking, and the squirrel looked stunned himself. The way my ex, the big game hunter, looked when I told him I was now a vegetarian. We'd run into each other at a street fair in Poughkeepsie. The hot dog he was eating froze in his hand, pointed like a stubby finger. Accused me of everything I'd thought I'd wanted and what I'd killed to get it. So it really wasn't until I moved to New Hampshire in 2005 that I really started feeling like a New Yorker. Which is, I think, what happens to us when we leave the places we really feel at home. 57. So I wanted to read the title poem to this book, Home by Now. I'm going to also read a poem in a bit called Code Orange. You can probably all remember the code system, the color code system we had when we knew we were supposed to be very afraid, especially at the airport. And it'd be interesting to see if we go back to that. Home by Now. New Hampshire air curls my hair like a child's hand curls around a finger. Children? No, we tell the realtor, but maybe a dog or two. They'll bark at the mail car, Margaret's Chevy Supreme, and chase the occasional moose here in this place where doors are left unlocked and it's code green from sun up, meaning go ahead and feel relieved. The terrorists are back where you left them on East 20th Street and Avenue C. In New York, we stacked our emergency packs with whistles and duct tape. In New England, precautions take a milder hue. Don't say pig on a lobster boat or paint the hull blue. Your friends in the city say they'll miss, but don't blame you. They still cringe each time a plane's overhead, one ear cocked for the other shoe, which is dropping now. I used to own a really big pickup truck, and I wanted to write kind of an ode to that truck. And at the same time, I was reading this biography of Henry Ford, who actually was buddies with Hitler, it turns out. Hitler actually had a photograph of Henry Ford up on the wall of his office, and Ford was supplying the Nazis with equipment and setting up factories in Nazi Germany. I mention the Frost Place, which is a Poetry for Center of the Arts up in the White Mountains in New Hampshire. And a paean, which a lot of you will know, is a metrical foot in poetry of one stressed and three unstressed syllables. On learning that Henry Ford was an anti-Semite. Now I am ashamed I bought that pickup truck, brand new off the lot in 1989. And a custom cap to match the F-150 super cab, alpine green with chestnut trim. She saved my life, Large Marge, when I fell asleep and took out a tamarack and stone wall. She kept me dry in Shenandoah when a creek swallowed my tent. She never lost her nerve climbing Titusville's icy hill. She never lost her, she carried a winter's worth of wood from Rhinebeck to Germantown, a piano from Poughkeepsie to LaGrange, and a paean of poets, one stressed, three unstressed, from the Kinsmen to the Frost Place for readings, then back for more booze. It wasn't a Dodge or a GM, but that truck paid its dues. Did I say ashamed? I meant never again. One more older poem. I know that the poets in here know Keats's La Belle Dame sans merci. Merci. And I thought that the woman in that poem really gets a bad rap, and I wanted to kind of give the woman's point of view. So this is La Belle Dame from a woman's point of view. And when I say the word knight, it's knight with a K. Her voice was songbird blue. Her hair, bedroom black. And men didn't know which to love or which to fear. But when they had to make a choice, it was what she lacked they blamed her for, and so could turn their backs guilt-free. If only she could explain, it was all that singing, it was all that wild honey, but more, it was those nights. One after another, pulling her onto the horse, asking her to sing, always with that line, "Has anyone ever told you?" Then soon enough, the two would come upon that hillside where late in the day the dew was stubborn, and here he'd beg for mercy. Then sleep. Was it mercy they sought or pity? Later, she wasn't sure. She'd run out of both for herself before she'd run out of either for them. Even when there seemed to be nothing left in her to give, she managed to find a drop or two of something, until at last she'd given it all away. And when the night awoke, she was gone. Gone, just like that, he told his friends at the Mermaid. And they nodded, full of pity, and said they too had been victim of that bitch, that tease. And the knight, feeling so much better, ordered drinks all around. I had a professor in college who challenged me to write a poem with no I in it. Basically said, stop writing about yourself, write about other things. So I tried writing a poem called Poem with No I in It, and it was a total failure, but I got this out of it. And I'll just tell you, for historical reasons, it's set in New York. It's dated December 2001. When I lived in the city, my apartment faced downtown. I could see the World Trade Center from my writing desk. And I was on the top floor of my building, which had heat provided. So a lot of times it was very hot in the apartment. I would leave the windows open all winter long. And for months, this smoke would come wafting up uptown, and sometimes you would just wake and the whole apartment would be filled with smoke. And you really had to think about what was in that smoke. It really smelled like nothing I had ever encountered before. So this is called George Says, Stop Writing About Yourself. I guess this is when writing about 9/11 started taking me by surprise. This one's for George, who urged, take off those shit-kicker boots. Leave your husband wrapped in the scroll of last night's sheets. Forget your mother sipping a cigarette, a Dugan's Dew. Forget your other mother and your other father, too. And the one you last saw in a coffin not looking at all like himself. So much not him you couldn't bear to be near that body. Forget your first kiss, how it sounded like peanut butter, tasted like a train. Stop talking about the Alabama slammers and four blue whales or those men you drove crazy with your push him, pull him love. And don't speak of babies, about not having them, or the ugly one who's so much a part of your nights, she must be real. Her mongrel face breaking into sadness. Don't talk about holding her above your head, calling her sweet girl, mama's girl, how she almost smiles. Just for George, this poem looks beyond sea monkeys and that first Louisville slugger. It opens the window to the stench, 3 months now of that smell, man-made, human, wafting from downtown. This poem is in the street where war does its thing. See, there's a man walking up Broadway. His shoes, suit, eyelashes, lips, covered in dust that used to be a building. I guess I haven't felt as devastated about the state of the country as I did on 9/11. Till now. And a lot of my students have been asking me, like, how do you write? How do you write now? And you just have to say, like, how do you not, right? I think that's our job as poets, as writers, is to speak truth and to speak to power. I'm going to read a new poem. I'm working on a sequence of poems inspired by a book called 100 Birds and How They Got Their Names. And so I've just, I'll read a description of a bird and I just use that as a launching point. And I spent most of my childhood growing up in the Hudson River Valley in New York State. So this is set there. I actually, right out of undergrad with my English major degree, worked for a gas and electric utility. And one of the things I did was give power plant tours. And there were these great rumors going around about the woman, my predecessor, tour guide, that really stuck with me, so she wound up being the star of this poem. This is called Looking for Eagles. From the power plant roof, they can see north, Poughkeepsie, lights on the bridge. When they face south, they can see even further, past Newburgh Beacon's bridge to the prow of a barge being tugged upriver. Its belly full of oil, the next shift will unload. She stands apart from the men. She, just the tour guide, not part of them, though they both seem kind and showed her the way here. A metal ladder, then the door that lifts like a lid. Eagles, they'd said, nests nearby. Morning's a show as the birds ride valley air, scanning the Hudson for striped bass or shad or whatever is running. Maybe none are hungry today. Unlike the insatiable machines below, boilers a story high. The turbines' ceaseless spinning make a whole city go. What she tells the school kids and Boy Scouts earning badges. So every time they flip a switch, they think Roaston, think Dan Scammer, the plant next door named for the Dutch who sailed up the river, spotted a whirl of Indians on that point of land and called it the Devil's Dance Chamber. Dan Scammer, spewing its blackish plume, officially never smoke, ever. Max lights a spliff. Pablo shakes his head no, but Max says she won't mind. The smoke's sweet punk makes her quiver. Max says he's seen an eagle dive then burst from the surface, eel a live rope in its talons. Pablo takes a toke, offers the joint. Max remembers she's done this before. Wasn't she here with the coal-burning boys? Quite a party, they'd heard, her face streaked with soot. She stops mid-drag, already the pot's ruffling the edges of her brain. She takes a full hit before handing it back. The kids who come here think the eagles are bald, she says. It's just that their head feathers are white. Max waves the joint. She's as smart as they say. Her head's all a whirl, but she's ready to run. She's lean and lank and faster than they. The door's right behind her, shut but not locked. Her brain's a flag unfurled, heart all flutter and angst. Max flicks the roach, turns to the river and points. At eye level, three eagles circle then soar as if racing the train on the opposite bank. I'm just going to read three more. This is a sonnet called In the Days of Code Orange. In the days of Code Orange, terrorists might take the Empire State Building next. Might take you or me or the red eye to LA. Our fears escalate like the news anchor's tits. We're not sure if they're real or not. The men in black keep such secrets secured in the public's interest, yet they're never hung up by facts. Meanwhile, a woman dies cold in the park. An underemployed chef is driving a cab. A foster mother starves the boys in her care. The anthrax assassin sits tight in his lab. They'd drill ground zero if oil were there. Love, let's live by a code the color of wine. We have this cup and so little time. It's just one more. I'm just going to end with a poem called A Grasshopper Walks Into a Bar. Seems like a really appropriate place to leave you, in a bar. It's a longish poem. It's in the voice of a woman bartender in the 1980s. So I'll mention smoke eaters, which there used to be these contraptions, kind of look like an air conditioning unit they'd have in the ceiling, and it's supposed to suck up all the smoke, but really just made a lot of noise. And I'll mention Son of Sam, who was a serial killer in New York City in the 1970s, and he was a sheet metal worker, otherwise known as a tin knocker. And you're going to hear parts of this joke, but you never get to hear the whole thing. So I'm going to just tell it to you really quick. So this grasshopper walks into a bar, and he hops up into the stool. And the bartender says, "Hey, we've got a drink named after you." And the grasshopper says, "You've got a drink named Bob." Yeah, told to me by a 7-year-old. So you never know where a poem's going to come from. So thank you, guys. I'll end with this. The trick is to pay close attention to that vodka you're pouring and lie. Nope, haven't heard that one. Then grab the OJ, glance out toward the pool table to see if Phil's watching you as PJ or Tin Knocker Sam says, and the grasshopper hops under the stool. Linda sees you're on edge. She's on her fourth pint since 7:15. You like her, start to wonder if she'll cut herself off when the bartender in the joke says, "We've got a drink named after you." "One for the road?" asks Linda. You check your watch. It's only 9 o'clock, and already the smoke eater's snapping like a wet towel. Already there's a line of quarters shining like Mary Mac's buttons down one side of the pool table's faux mahogany bumper, and there's Phil shouting, "Rack 'em." "One more," you relent. Sam says he's buying. Sam still waiting for his quarters to come up. You were about to tell the Valley Girl joke, but now he's telling you how Son of Sam works sheet metal too. And sad thing is, he thinks he's flirting. It's Friday, and you've got a full bar, 3 deep, and every seat taken. The 5 Miller brothers filling the corner by the jukebox, singing along to Take It Easy, and waving for another round of ponies. It's Miller they want. What else? And because Richie didn't fill the cooler last night, you've got to run back to the walk-in for a bottle of Rosie's and a case. Ed offers to help, as he always does, but you haul your own behind the bar unless a keg kicks. You rest a moment in the cooler's 40 degrees, your breath a trail of smoke. The rubber mat's a bit slick. Each time you come here, you're struck by how the cigarette reek in your hair mixes with the musk in your turtleneck, and it doesn't smell bad. You remember that short story where the guy sticks his dead mother in a restaurant freezer? Remember how Mark kissed you here the night before his wedding, how his glasses frosted over, how he tasted like bourbon and fear. Lugging out that case, you know the local boys will back you up. They think you're tough. Yeah, you can fake it as well as Linda can fake she's sober. That is, up to a point. Now Phil's out by the pool table slinging cusses at some Vassar boy, something about calling a shot. Phil can never know about Mark. It was just that once. Shit, he'd kill you. How many has he had so far tonight? You eye the baseball bat between the trash can and keg of Michelob, glad the Millers are still banging those bottles, yucking it up through Cyndi Lauper, waiting for the next Eagles tune to come up. The boys have backed you before. They won't mess with Phil. It's an unspoken fact, he's your man. But they can escort out the college kid if things get ugly. Your head's humming, you're gulping Diet Coke, regretting the line you did off Kathy's finger in the ladies. You call goodnight to Mr. Dugan, hoping a fight doesn't ruin your shift or your chances for a decent tip from whoever wins the table. You watch Mr. D sway in some unseen wind as he reaches the door. Thank God he's walking home. You'll walk home too after you lock up, but that's a jukebox of songs and a stockpile of jokes from now. That's after the pool table's gone quiet, like water when kids are through swimming. After the cues are stowed in the umbrella stand, after the Miller brothers have harmonized Desperado. You'll cash out, slam a shot, pour the tip jar into your purse, elbow the light switch, turn the key in the door, and set the alarm. You'll step lightly across the parking lot, past Phil's truck, and Phil passed out at the wheel, knowing he's been out here waiting for you. You'd hoped he'd gone home. He doesn't think you're a tough girl. He thinks you're his, and you flirt too much behind that bar. He thinks he knows what love is, and as soon as he wakes, he's gonna come pounding on your door to prove it. And though, like a bad joke you've heard before, you know what's coming next. You'll rise from bed, unbolt the door, and let him in. Thank you.
And please welcome our next introducer, who will introduce our next reader, and that is Eleanor Boudreau.
Hello. Hi. So when I was thinking about what I was going to say to introduce Dana Levin's fabulous poems, I spent a lot of time thinking about the quality of the images, which are spectacular. So Dana Levin's poems often begin with an image that then takes on the quality of a story. And that's not my original observation. I'm paraphrasing Louise Gluck. But it is to say that things happen to the images in Levin's work. They're not stagnant. So in this way, the images in Levin's poems are like objects in the real world that are changed and gather resonance over time. Like a souvenir brought back from a vacation, or a family watch passed down from generation to generation, or a bracelet that you wear every day because you love it. And at this point, its fixation on your wrist gives you comfort. And because the images in Dana's poems are so often of live beings and human beings, the change they undergo mimics the process of aging. The way your child face gives way to something that is not itself is monstrous. Unless you believe that change is the permanent human condition, the only fundamental part of existence. It is platitudinous to say that poems change us, even if it's true. Levin's poems are the change in us, affecting, wounding, instructive, a constant reminder of our own mortality and conversely of the importance of the present moment. It is a fiction to believe that we can revert to a previous state, a fiction politicians are willing to perpetuate, but we should not believe it. We should not be willing to accept it. We live in very changeful, uncertain times. And we need Levin's poems, poems that live in change now more than ever. She is a rare poetic genius who seems to have come out fully formed in her first book, In the Surgical Theater, and gets better with every book since. She's won all sorts of prizes. She has a bunch of pushcarts to her name, a Guggenheim, a Penn Award, a National Endowment for the Arts grant. Dana, please forgive me for not listing all of your awards. Your work means so, so much to me. I really love your poems, and I, for one, came here tonight to hear you read them. So it has been a great, great honor for me to introduce you. Please join me in welcoming to the stage a brilliant poet with fabulous hair, Dana Levin.
Thanks for not leaving. It's fucked when people leave. I mean, like, personally. Everybody has a life. So you win. Maybe. I want to thank you for staying. I want to thank you for coming. I want to thank Aaron Ballou for bringing me here. I want to thank Keith Kopka for being amazing. I want to thank Eleanor for her intro and for being very friendly. It's really great to spend real time with real people and not just in a virtual space, if you know what I mean. Aaron, are you here? Okay. I was a little scared to read to you from this book because it's about the end of the world, but I'm just going to do it. So in this first poem, what you should know is that I was teaching undergrads. We were reading this book called Averno by the poet Louise Glück, and that book is about Persephone and Hades and Demeter, and if you know your Greek mythology, you know that Persephone was this young virgin, and the god of death came and took her away and abducted her into the underworld, and we were talking about Persephone, and we were talking about ghosts, because we were talking about the underworld, and then we started talking about the soul, and then I was like, what is the soul? Like, what is it? And then I said, take out your phones. Let's look up the definition of soul. So everybody took out their phones, and they were, you know, really looking into them, holding them over this physical book, which is about this figure, which is pre-literate, comes from a pre-literate side, you know, before things were written down. Persephone precedes writing. And in that moment of having this book about a goddess, physical pages, digital phone, looking up the definition of soul, like time and space collapsed. This is gonna drive me insane. So this poem begins at that space. It's called Across the Sea. And it mentions Marconi, who was a pioneer of early radio. He actually believed that if he could just create the right kind of machine, he would be able to hear any sound that was ever made by anyone. Like, he thought he could find Christ's cry on the cross, like just kind of floating around out there. He was not able to build this machine. Christ's cry in Aramaic is Eli Lama Sabachthani, my God, why have you forsaken me? That's in this poem. There's the mention of Sibyl in here, which is a prophetess, not the woman with 16 personalities. Across the sea. We used our texting machines to look up the definition of soul in the middle of class. Thumb joints at work above the stitched paper of actual books in which we'd been reading poetry about a prophetess, one of the human cave-bound time machines. She had traveled a long way through the four dimensions to be with us, from someone's mouth to someone's ear, someone's hand to tablet, papyrus, parchment, paper, the liquid crystal light of our computer screens. Liquid crystal light, they'd really called it that, the inventors at Marconi Wireless. See if you can hear anything, Mr. Kemp, Marconi had cried the day they sailed the letter S across the sea. I love the synesthesia of that. See if you can hear, they'd coaxed some radio waves to propel the alphabet through the air. Was that Marconi wishing? He was a liquid crystal light and not a break of bones that had to fear the future. A human-headed bird, the Egyptians said. A butterfly, an innermost. A website I was afraid to enter, wewantyoursoul.com. The students laughed and laughed. Soul adorning, soul afflicting, soul amazing. Soul and body lashings, they really called it that. The ropes they wound round oilskin to keep out sea and storm are sailing men. Who sent the cheeriest message you could imagine to usher in the telegraphic age. Thanks, am well. The soul, it was an ellipse in white. It fizzed, their chaplain said, with God's CPR, breath of life. So they could travel through length and width and depth and time and man a ship, where someone in a small room would tap out a message to a far man on a far shore and they would understand one another. He shared all roads and he braved all seas with me, all threats of the waves and sky is what the hero says of his dead father. But it sounded like soul to me. Guide, companion, captain of the ship of flesh I had to ride where I was a third thing in the closed grip of the body's vise. Marconi, he thought he'd hear the agony of Christ with a sensitive dial to help him sieve. He trawled the frequencies. For Eli Lama Sabachthani, no song lost, no impress of tongue and teeth that made a sound ever lost. If you had a receiver, a virgin, say, in a mountain crag, or a brain bot from the nano future, did it matter which? You'd have a house for a god's mouth, and it would message you your rescue. Rescued from what is what I'm trying to mean. Rescued from what? You have to fear the future more than you used to, which sounded like the soul waving a series of flags at me. We wanted arrival to be instant because we didn't want to be separate from what we loved. Wireless, weightless, and omniscient is how we refined our machines. We had a dream that we could smash the bands of matter and time and still be alive. Was that the soul wishing? We would invent the body out of existence, so many of us now enthralled by doom. The students peer so deep into their handheld screens, they look like diviners. Each one a scrying Sibyl at the world's end. Scribbled on leaves thrown out of their caves and into the wind. the only part of the epic I make them read just after the crew is borne ashore, but before the walk amongst the dead. The part between, where there's a body agonized by light and someone lost and a query. How we doing? I'm putting on my glasses so I can see you. Okay, I think we're okay. Can you hear me too? That's the other question. Okay. In this poem, I am the guest on a series of very strange television talk shows. A reviewer described these as taking place in a post-human world. Talk show. I'm being interviewed on a television talk show. I'm an expert on breathing. So, the host croons, oxygen, how's that feel? Like having an alien in your chest, I say, and the live audience roars. Let's see you breathe, the host says. Go ahead, lung up. And I do, inhaling and exhaling to wild applause. You can totally laugh. It's billed as an in-depth two-part exclusive on retaining the use of all my limbs. Which do you like better, the host asks, twirling your hair or jiggling your foot, opening a door or kicking it closed? Which, he leans in, would you prefer, Parkinson's or polio? Flustered, I start to stand up and he slaps his hands to his face saying, she's standing up, ladies and gentlemen, she's standing up, and I freeze to mounting applause, half in and half out of my chair. It's another television talk show, and I'm the doctor of digestion, a metabolic whiz. They wheel me out to the stage, perched on an old-timey stand-up scale. So, the host croons, food, how's that feel? Someone cues video, and we turn to montage, laparoscopic images of everything I've had to eat for the last 3 days. Carne adobada, the announcer booms, split pea soup. Each announcement meets with wild applause. When the video ends, I turn back to the host, but find you smoldering comfortably in the host's appointed chair. You lean forward, smiling. Your skull eye gleams. You stick your black boned finger right down my throat. Okay, in this poem, you are at urgent care, and things are not moving very urgently. How many of you have had that experience? Oh yeah. Woo. So you're waiting at urgent care, and there's a guy that's like sitting one seat away from you, and he might be a little crazy, but you're gonna chat. And this guy likes to collect CAPTCHA. Do you guys know what CAPTCHA is? Some of you do. How many of you know what CAPTCHA is? Wow, interesting. So this was more prevalent in the early days of the internet, but it can still happen where if you're gonna send somebody an article or something like that, they make you retype the words that are kind of swoony or blurry or whatever. That's called CAPTCHA, and it's actually a Turing test. It's for a server to determine that you're actually a human being and not a computer virus trying to infiltrate, which is why you have to do that. So this guy collects CAPTCHA, because in the early days of the internet, we got great weird phrases, which are going to be peppered through this. Now it's just like HT swoony 8LX. And before that, it was it actually had language. The Farmer's Almanac is mentioned in here, and I hope when my voice changes, you'll know that there are quotes from that. Anyway, you're going to be at urgent care for a long time. Okay. Oh, and there's a lunar eclipse that is about to happen. Urgent care. Having to make eye contact with the economy. A ball cap that says, in dog years, I'm dead. The moon will turn blood red and then disappear for a while, the TV enthused. Hunched over an anatomy textbook, a student traces a heart over another heart. Lunar eclipse. In the bathroom, crayoned graffiti. Fuck the heart, you know. He collected CAPTCHA, one seat over, Mr. Feverish Mange denied. like Puzzling Sabbath or Street Pupas. We shared some recent typos. I mediated his, my tiny bots of stimulation. He loved the smudged and swoony words that proved him human. Not a machine trying to infiltrate the servers of the New York Times from which he launched Gad Shakes or Hefty Llama, obits and exposés, some recipes, a digital pic from someone else's black disaster. He lobbed links at both of his fathers, step and bio, a few former lovers, a high school coach, a college chum, some people from where I used to work. So much info we both agreed. The umbra, the TV explained, shadow the earth was about to make. And if during the parenthesis they felt a strange uneasiness, firing rifles and clanging copper pots to rescue the threatened, so benighted and hopelessly lost, their eyes to the errors, moon lore, farmer's almanac, waiting room, hour two. Urgent care. That was pretty multivalent. As in, we really need you to take care of this. We really need you to care for this, to care about this. We really need you to peer through the clinic's storefront window on alert for the ballyhooed moon. And there it was, reddening in its black sock deep in the middle of the hour of someone else's nutso-tinsel talk on splendor. My fevered friend, describing the knocked-out flesh, each of our heads fitting like a flash drive into the port of a healer's hands. We still good? Okay, so do you guys know what it's called when they come up with weird names for groups of animals, like a murder of crows or a gaggle of geese? Does that have a name, what that is? Collective nouns? Thank you. Okay, I made up a collective noun, a debris field of apocalypticians. So this poem is called A Debris Field of Apocalypticians, A Murder of Crows. And there's a word in here, Umwelt, which is German, and it comes out of Gestalt psychology, and it just kind of means your whole outer environment. A debris field of apocalypticians, a murder of crows. The fact of suffering is not a question of justice. Belief in God is not a disease. Our father projections met and disaster ensued. Earth is our only time machine. Our mother projections met and disaster ensued. Everyone is sick from what we made. He wanted you to ask him how he felt. He didn't give a shit about your Umwelt. But your heartburn, biome, phone bills, research. Your temperature, heartbreak, dust mites, checkbook. Your live ones, loved ones, languishing spider mums. They just needed some shit to make them grow. The fact of suffering is not a question of justice. Everyone is sick from what we made. You watched monks change sand into a palace of time, wheeled through an age of unpardonable crimes. So the title poem of this book, the book is called Banana Palace, which is where we live. And I don't know if you've ever had this experience on social media, especially like Instagram or Facebook, where you're just kind of like, oh my God, what is that? Has that ever happened to you? Oh yeah. So this happened to me, and I had this moment, and I was like, it was an image that somebody had posted, and it just blew my mind, and then I saw what it was, and I was like, oh man, I really want to write about this image, but I didn't know how to do it without writing about Facebook, which seemed like a really dismal subject for poetry. So I just was like, Muse, help. And about a year later, I came back around to really wanting to write about this image, which I'm not telling you what it is on purpose. And I was like, all right, you are going to have to write about Facebook, so how are you going to do it? I was like, well, who needs to know about Facebook? Well, somebody who doesn't know what Facebook is. Well, who doesn't know what Facebook is? Well, obviously somebody from a post-apocalyptic future who has no memory of the civilization before. And once that idea occurred to me, I was able to write this poem. So the poem begins sort of in the present moment, but pretty soon it's going to be spoken by this person who has lived in our world as it stands today, but has also miraculously survived apocalypse and is out there in the post-apocalyptic world trying to tell somebody younger what this was, both Facebook and finding this image. And by the end of the poem, I'll tell you what it is. Banana Palace. I want you to know how it felt to hold it deep in the well of my eye. You, future person, star of one of my complicated dooms. This one's called Back to the Dark. Scene one, death stampedes through the server cities. Somehow we all end up living in caves, foraging in civic ruin. Banana Palace. The last of the last of my kind who can read breathes it hot into your doom-rhymed ear. She's a douser of spine-broken books and loose paper. The rest of your famishing band thinks mad. Mine was the era of spending your time in town squares made out of air. You invented a face and moved it around, visited briefly with other faces. Thus we streamed down lit screens, sharing pictures of animals looking ridiculous. Trading portals to shoes, love, songs, news, somebody's latest rabid cause, bosses, gluten, bacon, God. Information about information was the pollen we deposited, while in the real fields, bees starved. Into this noise sailed Banana Palace. It was a mothership of gold, shining out between Happy B-Day, Katie, and a photo of someone's broken toe. Like luminous pillows cocked on a hinge, like a house with a heavy lid, a round house of platelets and honey. It was open, like a box that holds a ring. And inside, where the ring would be. I think about you a lot, future person. How you will need all the books that were ever read when the screens and wires go dumb. Whatever you haven't used for kindling or bedding. Whatever made it through the fuck cluster of bombs we launched accidentally at the end of the era of feeling like no one was doing a thing about our complicated dooms. Helpless and braced, we sat in dark spaces, submerged in pools of projected images, trying to disappear into light. Light. There was so much light. It was hard to sleep. Anyway, Banana Palace. Even now when I say it, symbols shiver out in spheres. It starts to turn its yellow gears and opens like a clam, revealing a fetal curl on its temple floor, bagged and sleeping. A white cocoon under lit strings that stretch from floor to ceiling. A harp made of glass, incubating a covered pearl. We broke the world you're living in, future person. Maybe that was always our end, to break the jungles, to get at the sugar, leave behind a waste of cane. There came a time I couldn't look at trees without feeling elegiac, as if nature were already over, if you know what I mean. It was the most glorious thing
I had ever seen. Cross-section of a banana under a microscope, the caption read. I hunched around my little screen, sharing a fruit no one could eat. Thank you. Okay. Murray Mai, this is about my cat. He does not fare well in this book. Actually, what I will say is that what I started to think a lot about in terms of the end of the world was appetite and how that was what was going to do us in the end. Right? Appetite? Bye! Murray Mai. Murray Mai, feed me, caterwauler. A meat sack with another meat sack for a pet, I tended hunger. His and mine, his the baby moles he'd bat to death, the low slung hunt near the sink for chicken grease, my teacher beast. He liked it raw or cooked or canned or kibbled. He'd clip a claw to my lower lip if I was asleep, so that I'd pad to the kitchen and slop his bowl with seafood medley or chicken beef. I'd grab him up, squeeze so tight I thought I'd pop, croon silly, 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 and watch his eyes close down to slits. I tended hunger. It was on my mind a lot as I watched the climate curl and bang. Were you watching too, wondering if you'd hesitate to eat your cat in the new extreme of flood and flame? I had a brute hypochondria about the future's body. All around me, summer burst its sack of seeds and trumpet horns of purple blue I loved so much I cut them once to bring inside, where they promptly died. And thus I knew, no matter how much I loved the world, to hunger was to be a destroyer. I got three more for you, okay? Can you handle it? All right, thank you. Okay, so this poem, it's kind of the same person from Banana Palace. As I was thinking about wanting to write a poem about the apocalypse, which, by the way, I will not survive. I am over 50, I am overweight, I am out of shape. The only way this is going to work is if you all decide that I am a shaman and that I will be the shaman crone woman you will carry around on a litter and I will dispense my wisdom. Will you vote for me? Right. My plan is working. But so in this poem, I have survived the apocalypse. I am living in a cave. I am half out of my mind. And when I am not busy trying to eat and not be eaten, I am thinking about the things that I loved from the world before. So here's the poem, at the end of my hours. Here, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here, 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 cricket pulse. The katydidic tick, and then a pause, tick, and then a pause in greening trees. Tales of a gratitude for water, the hollyhock's trumpet, yes, tenderness, her glove and hoe. Her bad trip, love, grief, her medic tent talking me down, kissed fissures in the world's despair, what I'd loved. Alive for a while. A day called rip and brood, a day called glorious hour, the long hunt and the worm found in the battered petunias. Every morning in summer, that last summer, before the bees collapsed and the seas rose up to say, fuck you. Perplexed by how it hadn't been unfailingly compatible, our being numerous, how half the time we couldn't see the shapes we were supposed to make made grave our disasters, a god's glass bearing down to burn the wheat crop, to keep time alive inside a tomato, splicing fish into fruit. Some wanted to defy limitation, were offered famine, bric-a-brac townships, virtual cities, where you could stand in market aisles still expecting cherries. His rhythms were your rhythms, Murray the cat. Sleeping adieu, draped your length from hip to knee like a scabbard, unsheathed his yawn, tortured finches for breakfast, yowled and yowled round the ravaged bowl till you fed him chicken. From your own plate, another mouth purling the wheel of appetite, covering a bloody mash to keep it going. Such a dumb rondeau, who invented it? Eating to live, to kill, to eat, even cat on a stick when fields failed. No crave for rain against the blasted scape, nor love nor God at the end of my hours, but garlic and butter, a splash of cognac, steak, frites. And when soil burned and order failed and dogs then people starved in char, I remembered an extraordinary piece, the privilege of being left alone with bread to eat and famous butter the chefs use, the venues of white sleep, cannabis and clonopin, the soma goods of art, and when my back went up against a blackened wall for rumored beans and dented cans, I forgot my body. Became a future remembering how it got that way, some blah, blah, blah about hoarding rivers and hiding gold. We died in droves. We killed each other and we killed ourselves until our bones wore out their plastic shrouds. I couldn't quite quit some ideas. Trees and chocolate. I couldn't stop yammering over the devastated earth, pining for nachos. Prescription drugs and a hint of spring, though I could see the new desert, its bumper crop of bone and brick from shipwrecked cities, where now the sons and daughters of someone tough are on the hunt for rat, the scent of meat, however mean, and a root sending an antenna up to consider greening. What poems built their houses for, once in a blinded age, teaching us the forms we felt in rescue. Hoarded up scraps whirling around my cave, trying to conjure peaches. There are some beautiful broadsides that were made. So from this book, I'm just gonna read the poem that they rendered, and then I'm just gonna read one more. The poem they rendered is called The Point of the Needle. I keep a garden. How many of you keep gardens? It's so great to keep gardens. Anyway, do you know what hollyhocks are? Very, very tall flowers with really, really beautiful, really tall stalks, flowers that kind of go like that. And one day I came out and something had just gone, oh my God, it was heartbreaking. And then I thought, all right, dudes, I really hope you get to turn into whatever you're supposed to turn into, or else this was just a big fucking waste. So this poem is to them, and then it kind of turns into a little meditation on reincarnation, The Point of the Needle. Since you got to behead each hollyhock crown with your round guillotine of a mouth, I hope you get to spin inside your paper house. Emerge noctuidae, owlet moth, laying your eggs in leaves at night. That you might finish your stitch, replicate yourself in time so you are always present. Each egg a deposit, an echo pearl of you along time's string. That my soul might be allowed to flourish, make a success of threading flesh, to participate again in time on long arcs between sets of plunge, even though it hurt to be born and die. It loved to ride The Point of the Needle. Bless you. All right, this is the last one. There's a very teeny poem in this book called Fortune Cookie. It is only two lines long. I was asked to write about its genesis, but I put it off. Do y'all put off stuff like that? And so I ended up writing this 4 days after the election. The poem, Fortune Cookie, goes like this. You will never get death out of your system. So here's what I said about it. I'm about to devote a host of words to this two-year-old prismatic scrap. It's November 12th, 2016, and death is once again on my mind. Check the date if you need to, future persons, present persons, idling ghosts. Day 4. How old is the Earth? I asked my machine, and it said 5 great extinctions, 1 in process, 4.5 billion years. It has always been very busy on Earth, so much coming and going, the terror and the hope ribboning through that. Like a stray dog you kick out of the yard who keeps coming back, its scent of freedom and ruin. Some people love death so much they want to give it to everyone. Some are more selective. Some people don't know they're alive. Metabolic system, financial system, political system, ecosystem, systems management running around trying to put out fires. Sodium nitrate, sodium benzoate, butylated hydroxyanisole, those are shit that keeps your food from rotting. Plastic surgery, Botox, Viagra, cryo chamber. Voting backwards into what has already died. Voting zombie in the name of change. Fortune cookie, the oracular feint of a joke future, where death is the trick candle on the victory cake. Some truths are hard to accept, especially when they won't budge beyond a couplet, especially when they won't tell you if they mean you well, if they herald freedom or ruin. You and death, lovers who just can't quit. That's how we make the future. The terror and the hope of that as change goes viral. Thank you so much.